Thank you. Okay, so perhaps in order to deal with this issue, which we've entitled tonight Meaning Within Suffering, which is often entitled Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People, the perspective that makes people uncomfortable is that either people feel that if there is the suffering of the innocent, suffering of those people who seem to have done no wrong, or at least not enough wrong to justify the amount of suffering that they encounter in their lives, it either perhaps leads to the conclusion that God is not in control, or that God doesn't care. Either of those two leaves us uncomfortable, because it goes against the grain of omniscient and omnipotent God. So what really needs to be tackled is a macro issue. Although everyone in their life will encounter difficulties, everybody in their life will have obstacles which they have to overcome. And they will ask themselves this question in a minor form. The answer is a macro answer. The answer is one which encapsulates the Jewish approach to difficulties, to obstacles, and essentially those obstacles, those tragedies can be a personal bereavement, or they can refer in recent history to something like the Holocaust. Either way, the answer is one that deals with an approach to understanding God's input, to understanding that God is in control and that God does care and that there is a pattern that this is following. Of course, at the same time, we have to realize that the answer is not going to be the equivalent of take two Panadol and you'll be fine in the morning. The question of suffering is one that philosophers have grappled with since there has been a science of philosophy. And some of the best minds through the ages have asked this question. And there isn't a one sentence answer. So that Elie Wiesel, who, as you are probably aware, wrote on the Holocaust, having been through the Holocaust, and questions what took place, it's not going to be a simple matter of saying to him, well, you just missed out this paragraph on page 78 as to why bad things happen to good people. And he's going to read that paragraph and then he's going to say, oh, well, now I understand it all. Now it all makes sense. Now I know why the Holocaust took place. I know why 6 million people died. I have reasons which explain to me all the difficulties that I've been through in life. I just didn't get hold of that page in the book. But now that I've got it, that's it. Clear as anything. It's not going to be a case whereby a person is going to do one simple thing or read one simple paragraph and suddenly I know everything that I've been wondering about. It's not going to be a simple cure to having an insight into why everything has ever gone wrong in my life. It's going to be a philosophical answer, one that gives me guidance, one that gives me a way to run my life when I encounter these issues. But it's not going to give me the answers as to why last Tuesday I missed the bus. That can only come when a person has perfect knowledge. A person can have an understanding of why things go wrong. They are not going to have an individually tailored response, an email from God that goes through the last few decades of their life and gives them line by line why this went wrong on a Wednesday and why that went wrong on a Monday. It's not going to happen. And what we need to therefore understand is an approach to tragedy, an approach to suffering. That is what Judaism, and for that matter other philosophies, but that is what Judaism offers us, and that's what we're going to be dealing with this evening. The meaning, the fact that there can be very real meaning within suffering, even though I'm not going to cross every T and dot every I. The answers that some people give may be very emotionally satisfying, but the fact that something makes me feel better doesn't make it real and doesn't make it true. We have to distinguish, obviously, between the comfort, the solace you give to somebody who's in the midst of suffering, to the philosophical approach we take to this question. When somebody is, God forbid, in mourning, there's no point in telling them, well, all you need to do is listen to this talk. Just download this onto your iPod, listen to this, and you'll feel fine about the fact that somebody in your family just passed away. So when a person is going through tragedy, a very different approach has to be used to giving them comfort. Because at that moment in time, people aren't able to see it from a macro perspective. People aren't looking for philosophy. They're looking for comfort. So this is not going to be the type of thing that a person can trot out at, a shiva house. Nevertheless, there will be elements within which will resonate even to a person who's suffering as they are being spoken to. The starting point for the answer that I'm going to be sharing with you this evening is obviously the Orthodox starting point. It is illegitimate to say to Orthodoxy, there is suffering, and you Orthodox don't have the answer to it, if the person asking the question is not prepared to look at it from an Orthodox perspective. They don't have to be Orthodox. But you can't ask a question about Orthodoxy without accepting Orthodox parameters. The Orthodox parameters that must be accepted are the three principles upon which Orthodoxy stands or falls. There are three governing principles to Torah Judaism. And they are non-negotiable. They are non-negotiable for the simple reason that we believe that God put them into existence. And we, human beings, cannot put aside that which God has made. The three principles are quite simply the fact that God exists. And by that we mean there are sub-paragraphs to this idea that there is only one God, that God is all-powerful, that God is all-knowing. But encapsulated in one line, it's the fact that God exists. The second aspect is that Torah, that a script came down to us at Mount Sinai, that it isn't just that we go through life and come to our own moral resolutions to issues, that we decide what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil. We have an absolute code which we refer to, and that code is called Torah. And thirdly, that there is the concept of reward and punishment. And part of that belief requires belief in the world to come. because absolute reward and punishment quite clearly don't take place in this world. We do see people who we know are totally wicked as far as it's ever possible to know about other people. But as far as we can see, these people are totally wicked, and we see them having a great life. So if the sum total of life is this world, there cannot be ultimate reward and punishment. It doesn't work. The model doesn't work. But if we accept that there is a concept of a world to come, then this model holds true. These are the three beliefs upon which orthodoxy rests: that God exists, that Torah was given to us at Mount Sinai, and thirdly, that there is absolute reward and punishment for deed, for action, for thought. Now, as I say, it's not that all of Jewry believes these things, but you can't question orthodoxy's approach to this question unless you understand that orthodoxy will answer this question from the context, within the context of these three points. Orthodoxy's answers to suffering will come based on the fact that there is a belief on these three ideas. So you can't ask the question and say, well, I don't believe in those three things, but I still want orthodoxy to come up with an answer. That's an invalid parameter. Orthodoxy can only answer the question of how suffering can take place within the context of the three beliefs upon which orthodoxy rests. Okay. Now, there is an episode in the Talmud, in the Gemara, in Tractate Menachos, where Moshe, it's quite topical, weeks in which we read the Torah being given, Moshe ascends Mount Sinai and, so to speak, finds God inscribing crowns on the letters of the words in the Torah. There are a number of letters. If you've ever seen a Torah scroll, there are a number of letters which are embellished with crowns. And Moses, so to speak, sees God adding these crowns to the letters. And Moshe says to God, who is delaying you? Right? It's not that sort of God mistimed the print deadline and he had to get the Bible out by the 6th of Sivan, but, you know, there was a strike and they couldn't get the vellum in and therefore had to use, silkscreen printing instead. It was a case where God is deliberately doing this at the last moment. And God responds to Moshe's question and says, there is an individual who will live generations from now, Akiva ben Yosef, Rabbi Akiva, known to us as Rabbi Akiva, the greatest exponent of the oral law, Moshe being the greatest exponent of the written, he is the greatest exponent of the oral law, Rabbi Akiva, and he will use each of these crowns to base Torah ideas upon. So, Moshe's immediate reaction is, show him to me. Show me his existence, so to speak. So God, IMAX, right? God says, no problem. And Moshe, so to speak, finds himself sitting in a lecture of Rabbi Akiva. And he's sitting on the 8th or the 18th row, the further back one sat in those days, the less of an understanding one had. And he's listening to this lecture being given, and he can't follow it. And he is troubled by this. And he says to God, you have somebody as great as this. Why are you giving Torah through me? Which obviously gives you an insight as to why the Torah calls Moshe the most humble of all people. So God says, this is how I want it to be. Okay. So Moshe says, show me his reward. A person who's this great his reward must be unbelievable. So God shows him the end of Rabbi Akiva's life, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. Rabbi Akiva was arrested by the Romans after the destruction of the Second Temple for teaching Torah in public, and he was publicly executed. They combed the flesh from him with metal combs. And Moshe says, Zu Torah, v'zu schara. This is Torah learning, and this is the reward for it. And God said, So kach olav machshava lefanai, be silent. This is how my thoughts are, so to speak. Now, on Yom Kippur, we, during the Musaf, towards the end of the Musaf, recount the end of Rabbi Akiva's life. But we follow it up. We follow it up with the fact that the angels protested. We deal with the 10 martyrs that were killed. And when the angels see these 10 sages being led out to execution, not all at the same time, but when these episodes take place, the angels protest and say, how can you do this? And God says, if you don't stay silent, I will return the world to tohu vavohu, to void, to the chaos that was there before creation started. And this seems to tell us the question is off limits. You can't ask why. You ask why, and you push me too far, I'll pull the plug, says God. I'll turn the world back to pre-creation. That's what it seems to be saying. But it actually is not the meaning of God's response. The meaning can best be understood by a parable. There was a king, there's always a king in a parable, right? So there's a king in this one. There was a king who had one day the idea that he should be suitably attired. And he scoured the land for a tailor who would do a proper job in creating the perfect garment. And he comes across this tailor who agrees to undertake the job. He buys 5 meters of the most expensive material in the land and creates a garment fit for the king. The king wears it, and after a while the whispers start. And one of the members of the king's government says to him, you know, there are only 4.5 meters in the garment. You do know that he took the extra 0.5 meter and used it for himself. So the king, although very happy with the garment, is rather annoyed at the liberty that the tailor has taken. And he calls the tailor in and he said, how could you do such a thing to me? So the tailor says, but your majesty, I use all 5 meters in the making of the garment. So the king says, no, I've measured it. I've measured, you know, the inside leg, and I've measured the waist, and I've measured it, and there's only 4.5 meters here. So the tailor says, okay, fine, no problem. Give me the garment. And the tailor takes hold of the garment and starts unstitching it. And the king says, what are you doing? He says, there's only one way to prove to you that all 5 meters are in here. I will undo it. I will return it to what it looked like in the beginning, and then you'll see that all 5 meters are here. But you can't see it, because you can't see the hidden folds. You can't see where the extra 0.5 meter has gone. So I'll prove it to you. You want to see how it works? No problem. I'll take you back to the state it was in before it was created, and then we'll go through 5,765 years of history, and then you'll figure out how things are running exactly how they are. But you're now in the year 5766 with a total of 20, 30, 40 years of existence behind you, and only your own existence. You don't know what's been going on in the world even while you've been around, and you want to understand all of it? You want to understand the questions? When your perspective is so limited that it wouldn't even register as a percentage point, as the sum total of human experience that has existed since Adam, how much do you take up? How many megabytes are you on that scale of everybody's existence? You don't register. And you want to understand with that tiny perspective why everything happens and has ever happened and will ever happen. Well, it's an invalid question. Where were you, God said to the angels, when I created the world? If you want to know why this is happening, there's only one way to find out. To be in at the beginning, before the world came into existence. And we'll take a walk through history, which will take thousands of years, and we'll have to go through the life of every individual. And then when we get to the end, you'll have a perspective. Of course, there is a slight issue that you have to be infinite in order to absorb all of this information. But, you know, that's one of those things. If you want to understand everything, you have to have that capacity. And at this moment in time, you simply don't have it. Which means that when we talk about faith, perhaps not always providing concrete, understandable answers, it might not always conform to what we would call logic. That doesn't make it irrational. Just because I don't understand something doesn't mean there isn't an explanation for it. It's just that I don't have that explanation to hand. It doesn't mean that I can't believe that there is a very valid, true, solid reason for what is going on. I just don't have the perspective to have that answer because I don't have the perspective of everybody's life. That doesn't make it irrational for me to believe that there is reason, that there is purpose to suffering. It's just that I don't know exactly what the reason is in the here and now. That's the beginnings of the approach that Judaism takes to this issue. And therefore, we find, using Wiesel as an example, he talks about how at the end of the war, he was in Buchenwald, and his family, as far as he was aware, had all been killed. There were actually two sisters who survived. But his family had been killed. His father died a week before the liberation. And he writes that they were still in this camp, although by now free men. And one night, some of the Jews who were sharing the barracks with him decided to put God on trial. And they appointed a jury, a prosecutor, a defendant, and a judge. And all the way through the night, they brought in witnesses. And at the end of the case, which was a night's work, the end of the case, the verdict was handed down. The verdict was quite clear. God is guilty. God is guilty. And at that point, he records that people came in and said, we're looking to make up a minyan to pray shacharit, the morning prayers. And some of the people in the barracks went and made up the minyan to pray. And the question is, you've just said that God is guilty. What are you doing? You've just pronounced God as guilty. And now you're going to pray to him? How can you live with that? How can you live by that type of rule? The answer is, from my perspective, my emotional perspective says, I can't understand any way through this other than to say that God is guilty. I can't see any other reason for why my family was killed. My family were people who never did harm to anybody. There can't be a reason for it. So you want to ask me the question? If I, the finite human being, am giving the answer to the question, the answer is God's guilty. Does that mean that God is guilty? No. But from my perspective, I can't see any other answer. And this explains why in Judaism we live a contradiction. Talmud tells us in the tractate Brachot, Kol manda ovid rachmona latav ovid. Everything that God does is for the good. It's axiomatic in Judaism. If God is all-knowing, God is all-powerful, that there was a purpose to creation, everything that God does in the world is for the good. If we believe that, then when we go to a funeral, no one should cry, because it's for the good. Everything, kol, everything that God does is for the good. That includes when God takes somebody's life. It's for the good. That's what the Talmud says. And even if you're going to say, well, you know, we're not on that level, we can't possibly reach that level. Okay, fine, so we can't do it. But there must be great people in each generation who believe and live by that statement in the Talmud. So how come when they go to a funeral, they cry? They should be saying, it's all for the good. And if it's all for the good, then it's something to rejoice over. God did this for a good reason. Not just for a reason, but for a good reason. So great! We should be happy! But even these great people are not. Even these great people mourn. And to make the question even more difficult to understand, God is the one that told us to mourn. The first day of the Shiva, the 7 days of mourning, is biblical. God tells us, sit on the ground and cry. The same God that tells us that everything that I am doing is for the good. Surely there cannot be a greater dichotomy, a greater contradiction than saying, sit on the ground and mourn, but what you're going through is for the good. How does that make sense? The answer is that the Jew lives in two worlds. And that's what I'm saying, that this answer only works if you believe in what Orthodoxy believes in. A Jew lives in two worlds. A Jew lives in this world and is aware that there is a world to come. Intellectually, we know that there is a reason why things happen. But emotionally, we live in this physical world. And God tells us to live with our emotions. We're not supposed to deny them. We're not supposed to ignore them. We're supposed to acknowledge them. And it hurts. And when it hurts, a person cries. For somebody to look into the Holocaust and say, well, you know, there was a reason for it all, and not feel any sadness, any pain, that person has failed in their sensitivity. There cannot be a purely intellectual approach to life or to Judaism. There has to be a living exponent of life that takes place in my personal existence. I have to feel, I have to experience life. And when someone cuts my finger, it hurts. So I sit on the ground and I cry. That doesn't mean that ultimately I deny that there is a purpose to this. Ultimately I know. But I experience pain. So they decided that from their perspective, from their pain, God was guilty. But that doesn't mean that God was. And that's why, I don't know how many of you read the book 60 for 60, 60 Days for 60 Years. In there is an essay from Elie Wiesel towards the very end, one of the last three essays, where he writes that even though I earlier wrote that I'd lost my faith, and earlier wrote that, you know, we were angry with each other, you know, we have to make up because I realize I'd never lost my faith. It's just that while you're going through the emotion, no point in giving a person a lecture on philosophy. It hurts. And they experience that pain, and the pain is real. So it doesn't matter how many books necessarily we read. The perspective on suffering is that there is reason, there is purpose. But as finite creatures, we only have a limited perspective. Sometimes in our life, we're fortunate to see why somebody suffered. There is an organization that exists in Northwest London, in North London as well, called Hatzalah. Anybody here heard of it? say, ambulance first aid, volunteer network, all the people who are active within it do it as unpaid volunteers, they are trained. How did this come into being? Because in New York, in Williamsburg, there was a chosid, I believe a Satmar chosid, who one day saw somebody collapse in front of them, and they needed a particular piece of medical equipment, which wasn't available, and that person passed away. And there and then they said, if I've seen this tragedy, it has been so that I should do something about it. And they started, on their own, this organization, which has spread to dozens of communities around the world, and has saved thousands of lives, because one person went through tragedy. In 1941, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who was the main pupil of the Chafetz Chaim, was living in Kovno, second largest town in Lithuania. And eventually, he was taken by the Germans and Lithuanians, and he was shot, he was killed. Within the last 3-4 days of his death, he spoke to the people around him, and he explained to them how they were to view what was going on from the perspective of a story. He said, imagine you have a city dweller who goes out into the fields, and they're taking a walk, and they see this beautiful field of green grass. And they are mesmerized by it. And as they're standing there, watching the view, some guy comes out with this machine and rips up all the grass. And the city dweller thinks to himself, the guy's crazy. Got a beautiful field and just destroys it for no reason. He hangs around and he sees the guy come out and take what seems to be food and throw it into the ground. By now he's convinced he's dealing with somebody who's crazy. Guy's an escaped lunatic. Not only does he rip his field to shreds, he then takes food and just throws it into the ground. But he hangs around. And eventually, what happens is that this is wheat, and it grows. And instead of green grass, there's a beautiful field of gold. He says, ah, now I understand. Now I know why he did it. This is much nicer. Hangs around. And of course, the farmer comes back out again and cuts all the wheat down. And once again, this city dweller is left convinced that this farmer is off his head. And he follows him, and he sees him take the wheat, and he rips it apart, and there's a tiny little bit that he takes. But that which had beauty, he just leaves for the cows to eat. And all he takes are a few husks within within the wheat. And he takes these husks and he crushes them. And once he's got them into a flour, he throws water into it, turns it into mud, and when he's finished all that, as if it couldn't get any worse, he then throws it into the oven to burn it. Of course, we laugh because we knew from the beginning of the story exactly what the purpose of everything was. But that's true of life. God knows why these things are happening from the beginning all the way through. We only see one perspective. And this analogy is very powerful, because what it tells us is that sometimes we even see the answer. We see the wheat growing and we think, oh, now I understand why I had to go through what I went through. And I still haven't got it. All I've got is part of the reason. Even though I now don't have any questions, the truth is that the answer I've got is still a superficial answer. I've seen the wheat growing, but that's not the purpose of the suffering. The purpose of the suffering is the bread. You've got a limited perspective, and you now are happy. Well, you can be happy, but you haven't got the information yet. It's not all there yet. And this is the approach that we have to understanding, not, as I said earlier, why something happened to me last Tuesday, but in a macro perspective, why is there suffering in the world? Why? Because there is meaning to suffering. What type of meaning? What type of possible meaning can there be? Okay, let's say I buy your idea. You tell me that there's a reason, that God has a plan. What possible reason could there be? How can there be benefits from suffering? You're telling me that there is a reason. Okay, I'll accept that. And I accept that you can't give me a detailed and analytical reason for every single piece of suffering that has taken place. But what possible purpose can suffering ever serve? The answer is, suffering promotes growth. This is an uncomfortable answer to hear in a Western society that is dedicated to creature comforts, that is dedicated to making life as easy and as painless as possible, to looking young forever, to living forever, and to doing so with minimum discomfort. But the truth of the matter is, if you think about it, any person that we regard as a real hero, and they don't have to be Jewish, in the secular world, somebody who we really admire, somebody who we look up to, they can even be a sports star, they never got to where they are without putting in real effort, without foregoing the easy life. Nobody became the number one in their sport by spending their Sunday mornings in bed. It doesn't happen that way. They spent hours and hours putting the effort in to growing. And eventually they became who they did. So we just see the end product. We see them winning at their sport. Or we see the person who we admire. But until you really read the biography, if it's true, until you read the biography, you don't know how much blood, sweat and tears went into creating that individual. And the truth is that that is what we should really be admiring. And heroes, in that sense of the word, are people who gave up on something that was convenient for something that was inconvenient because it was the right thing to do, because it was the correct choice to make. Those are people who we admire. Those people sometimes voluntarily put themselves through suffering because it made them into much bigger people. It made them the heroes that they became. Sometimes heroes involuntarily. They didn't do this for the acclaim. But heroism, real heroism, is a function of doing something that makes me uncomfortable, that makes me sacrifice something for something that is really important, for something that is, excuse me, meaningful. And with that in mind, we can understand why, when a child starts to walk, what do the parents do? They leave the child. The child is taking its first steps. Just when the child really needs the support of its parents, what do the parents do? Abandon the child. They walk away. And as the child comes a little bit closer and thinks, okay, this suffering is nearly over, parent walks even further away. How can you do that to your own child? Don't you love your child? Yes, it's because they love the child. Because if they didn't do this, the child would never learn to walk. So, of course, the parents could carry on carrying their child. And at the age of 45, they'd still be carrying their child. Because the child never learned to walk. Because we don't want the child to ever fall over. Because the child will hurt itself. That's an interesting approach to take. Because it means that the child will never develop, will never grow. Have you insured the child against pain? To a large degree, yes. You've made sure that nothing will interfere as far as you're able. But you're doing a tremendous disservice to the child, not a tremendous service. And having said that, therefore, there is purpose. Purpose which we can't always put our finger on as such, but purpose to suffering. Having said that, it is still very important to understand that there is a vast gulf between having a theoretical answer to this question and being able to cope with this question. The prayer that we say at the end of both the morning and afternoon and evening prayers is Aleinu Lashabeach, praise that we give to God. And we quote a verse in that prayer, verse from the Torah, V'yadata hayom, you shall know today, V'hashevosa el levavecha, you shall place it in your heart. What shall you know? What shall you place in your heart? Ki Hashem hu ha'elokim, that God is the only power, the only one in control, v'shamayim yim'al, in the heavens, v'la aretz mitachat, and on earth. What does this verse mean? V'yadata means to know intellectually. First thing we have to do is question, is ask, is inquire, is read. That's the first step to take. Judaism promotes questions in a way that no other religion does. Our children at a young age are encouraged on Pesach, ask questions. Because the first step to becoming more aware of life is to ask questions. So that's the first thing a person has to do. Ask. Having asked and having received the theoretical answers, there's a journey that now has to be undertaken. From yadia, from knowledge, to it being part of my emotional makeup, to putting it in my heart, to living with that knowledge. Because I know that something is true, doesn't mean I can automatically live by that knowledge. Anyone here ever been on a diet? Anyone here ever broken that diet? How? How you know why you went on that diet? And you know that you shouldn't be doing what you're doing. It should now be impossible for you to break the diet. It's not as if you're unaware of the consequences. So how could you ever do it? But we do. For the simple reason that theoretical intellectual knowledge only changes me in theory. To be changed in practice, I have to live by that knowledge. And until I do so, there are going to be contradictions in my life. And that is the journey of life. First to acquire the knowledge, and then to go from knowledge to making that part of who I am emotionally, in action, in speech, and in thought. I have to become that knowledge. That knowledge has to make me a greater person, not just a more knowledgeable one. And as such, we, even if we accept this answer wholeheartedly, are still going to struggle. Struggle on a micro level. When I do miss the bus, I'm still going to get upset. And if somebody opens the page in the Talmud that says everything that God does is for the good, I am liable to hit them. But I know the answers. How can I react that way? The answer is that I'm not living up to that knowledge at that moment in time because I'm a human being. And human beings have failings. And the job of life is to make sure that the failings diminish and that the victories increase. And the more I am able to cross that bridge from theoretical knowledge to practical application of that knowledge, the more I'm actually living life. There will be times when I stumble, there will be times when I fail. That's to be human. But what I have to do is try and bring that knowledge that there is such a thing as plan, as purpose. But that plan and purpose belongs in the realms of infinity. And while I am finite, I live with that belief. And sometimes God throws me a bone. Sometimes I'm shown why the suffering was worthwhile. Sometimes. Often not. What I do is I live with that belief and with that knowledge, which is predicated on a reason which makes sense, even though I don't have the logical answer to it. If I live by that life, then what I'm doing is I'm providing meaning within suffering. If there are any questions, I'll be glad to take them. Yes.
Suffering, like, you say somebody passes away, mm-hmm. like, say it's a child or something, then, mm-hmm. so that's good for them, for mm-hmm. their reward or whatever, but then their parents, everyone who's left behind is suffering as well.
So absolutely.
It is absolutely
measured. In the second last portion in the Torah, in Parshas Hazinu, God is described as Hatsur Tamim Pa'alo. The God is the perfect, literally, rock. The Midrash tells us to read the Tzur as Tzayar. God is an artist. If you were to watch an artist in action, you would see them start with a blank canvas, and they put a little bit of red there, and some yellow there, and some blue there, and some green in the far corner, and you can't see the picture happening. What you're seeing is blobs and dashes and basically scribbles on the canvas. But God is an artist, and the way artists work is that when the picture is finished, you see that there was perfection in each and every piece, and that the harmony came where there seemed to be a clash of colours, but only because there was a clash of colours could you reveal the depth in each. From a personal perspective, my father passed away when I was 8.5 years old. Now, there's no question about the fact that were I to rewrite history, I wouldn't rewrite that detail. But equally, there's no question about the fact that it gave me certain strengths which I used from then on. I would never ask for it. And it's important to understand that in our prayers every day, we ask God, do not bring me lidei nisayon. Don't bring me to tests or to trials. I don't need suffering in life. It's not that I feel that I'm lacking. But if God puts me to the test, there is a reason and a purpose to it. So yes, it includes all the components. Yes.
So can we ascribe meaning to something which occurs to us, or would that be incredible hubris according to what you say?
In other words, for us to give absolute meaning would require prophecy. That's one of the things that we lose by not having prophecy. So that anybody who will say to you, and I don't care how religious they are, if anybody says to you, the Holocaust happened because of X, that person is a fool. You cannot give a finite, one-line answer to something as broad as the Holocaust. And to a certain degree, you can't do it even within the context of a particular aspect of your life. Perhaps to put it this way. There are two words in Hebrew for the word why. There is lama and madua. What is the difference between the two? We find them both used in the end of the first portion of the book of Exodus, the end of Parashat Shemot. The Egyptian taskmasters, they come to the Egyptians and they say to them, madua lo chilitem. Why didn't you finish your work? The Egyptians demand of the Jews to finish their labor. Why didn't you finish? A few verses later, 6-7 verses later, Moshe is talking to God and he says, Lama shlachtani? Why did you send me as the emissary of the Jewish people? Because since the time I came, Heira la'am azeh, things have only got worse for the Jewish people. What's the difference between the word madua and lama? Madua means, I want to know what's going on here. So the taskmasters come and say, I want to understand why you didn't do it, what your excuse is, what happened. I want the full picture. When Moshe is talking to God, he doesn't say to God, I want the full picture. You can't get the full picture. What he says is lama. Lama means lama. For what purpose? I don't know why it happened, but my question is, what purpose will I put this event to? If I lived through a tragedy, how will I incorporate that into my life? Lama, to what purpose did we all live through a year where there was a tsunami? There has to be a reason to it. I don't know why the tsunami happened, and I don't know why these people lived and these people didn't. But I have to understand in my own life, lama, to what purpose will I put knowledge of suffering? The fact that I will understand that I'm mortal? The fact that it will give me a perspective on life? Maybe. So there are questions which are valid and questions which are invalid. Okay. We'll leave it there.